This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In many ways, the charter school movement is still in its infancy. 25 years after education experiments started, thousands of schools across the United States are using the model. It is a way to shift control away from school boards and into the hands of local school operators, building operators themselves. There are some success stories, but studies point to a lack of consistency in charter schools' performance, even in schools within the same state. David Osborne is a proponent of giving schools the power to set their own rules. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Reinventing Government. His new book is Reinventing America's Schools, Creating a 21st Century Education System. He's also a senior fellow and the director of Reinventing America's Schools Project at the Progressive Policy Institute, and he joins me now. David Osborne, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
We should really start out by defining a charter school. What is it?
Charter schools are public schools, open to all children, not allowed to discriminate, publicly funded, but they're operated by private organizations, usually nonprofit. There are a few for-profits, and they've actually given the sector a black eye in many cases. But the difference with traditional public schools, the other difference is that they have a lot of autonomy. The people who run the school can actually run the school. They can hire who they want. They can fire who they want. They can determine the educational program, the pay scales, and so on. But they're supposed to be, along with that autonomy, held accountable. And if the kids are falling behind grade level, then after, you know, their charter might be for 5 years, at the end, they don't get renewed and the school closes. And often, if the authorizer is doing it right, the school is replaced by a stronger operator. So it's that combination of autonomy and accountability and then school choice and the ability to create diverse models for different kinds of kids that's at the heart of the charter model.
And that was certainly the philosophy behind the movement as it got started. It would allow for choice. Schools didn't seem to be doing so well. How can we possibly come up with experiments that might yield a better result? When you say accountable now, are the accountability models different, or are all of them accountable in one way or another to the school board or to the local authorities?
Well, they're all theoretically accountable to their authorizer, and that differs. You know, we have 44 states and the District of Columbia with charter laws, and they're all different. So in North Carolina, you have a statewide board, an advisory board that is the authorizer. Essentially, legally, the state board of education is the authorizer, but the advisory board advises it,
Right. Recommends.
In other places, those I've written about, you actually have authorizers at the city level. Washington, D.C., for example, has a public charter school board that authorizes charter schools that educate almost half the kids in D.C. In Denver, the local elected school board is the authorizer. It has both traditional schools and a lot of charter schools, which it embraces. In New Orleans, the state recovery school district took over a lot of the schools after Katrina and gradually handed them to charter authorizers. Fastest improving system in the country. And next year, July 1st, they will all return to the local elected school board, which will have 100% charter schools. So this is by way of saying we have a lot of different models right. In a lot of different places.
Well, you write about the ones that work. We're going to talk about the many, many problems that can afflict charter schools. But let's talk about the ones that work, because those are the ones you wrote about.
You know, that's what we should pay attention to, right? We want to learn the lessons. Right. How can we do this in Raleigh, in Durham? How can we learn what's worked elsewhere?
Well, let's talk about New Orleans. So let's start there.
Okay. So as I said, New Orleans had a statewide recovery school district, which North Carolina now has, the Innovative Schools District. And after Katrina, the state legislature was so frustrated with the New Orleans schools. They were terrible. They were corrupt. They were almost bankrupt. And both parties agreed, let's take over most of those schools, put them in our recovery school district. Anything performing below the statewide average went into the recovery school district. And originally, Paul Vallis, who was superintendent, thought, well, I can operate schools as well as these charters, so I'll keep some of them as RSD operated and some of them as charters. Turned out he was wrong. Turned out the charters had higher performance, and so they did the logical thing. They, over 7 or 8 years, every year they turned about 5 over to charter operators. And The significant thing is they close or replace the ones that aren't working well. So every year you take away the weakest one or two schools and you hand them off, hand that building to one of the strongest operators. And so your pool gets stronger every year.
What are they doing that works?
Well, they're doing all kinds of things. They're, you know, different school models for different kids. There's everything from Montessori to highly structured to performing arts to deliberately integrated and diverse schools. There's a military and maritime academy. I mean, lots of models. But what really makes it work, and the reason that they've essentially doubled or tripled the effectiveness of the schools in New Orleans, is that the school leaders actually can create a model that works for the kids that they have. I mean, New Orleans is a very poor city. 85% of the kids live in low-income families. 82% are African-American. And you can't take the cookie-cutter American school and give it to those kids and expect it to work. So if you visit these schools in New Orleans, you know, it's almost like missionaries. They're working long hours. They're doing everything they can for these kids. They're giving the students in a high school the cell phone numbers of their teachers, and you're allowed to call until 10 p.m. if you need help. And they're hiring people whose job it is to get kids through college once they get to college, because, you know, they've gone above the state average on college going now. Huge success.
Are they spending more per student than they were, and how do they compare to the state average?
They're probably spending more than they were because the state is spending more than it was. I mean, as time goes by, and there's a little bit of inflation, they are a little. I'm trying to remember the latest numbers. Since it's a poor city, their local funding is a little, and state funding is a little below the state average. But their federal funding, Title I money for poor kids, is a little above the state average. So they're pretty typical in their funding. It's the reason they're better is not money. It's a different way of organizing. It's allowing that autonomy and then holding them accountable and making sure if the school's not working, it goes away.
Well, let's talk about the way in which it can work, because one of the ways, of course, you want a school to work is outcomes. You want students to be reading at or above grade level. You want them to be graduating. You want them to be showing up. That's a good indicator that things are going well. You'd like them to go on to college. These are good markers. And if these measures are improving, you say you've got a good school. One of the problems with charter schools is that if you don't hold schools accountable also for access and diversity, if you don't provide free and reduced lunch, if you don't provide transportation, you're very likely not to get the poorer students and therefore resegregate your schools. Did they avoid that trap?
They did, although it took a few years to work everything out. And I know that's a big problem in North Carolina. You kind of have a somewhat free market for charters with just one authorizer at the state level. But in New Orleans, where you've got two authorizers now in the city, and soon it will be back to one, they've spent the last 5 to 6 years solving all of these problems. First of all, they did require from the beginning that all the schools provide transportation. Because if you don't do that, you don't have equal access for the poorest families. Then they created a common enrollment system for all the schools. Almost all the schools. A few charters refused, but they, as soon as they have to be renewed, they'll be forced to join. So what that does, in a normal situation, if you're a parent who has the motivation, the knowledge, and the time to go visit, you know, half a dozen schools and apply to half a dozen schools, your chances of getting your child into a good school are much better than if you don't. But if you create a common enrollment system, a computerized system where everybody lists their top 5 or 6 choices and then the computer matches, everybody's on a level playing field. They did that. Then they had a problem with special education. You know, they weren't funding special ed kids enough so that a lot of schools wanted to avoid them because you could be bankrupted if you had a couple of really expensive autistic kids, let's say. They didn't want that. They didn't want schools trying to avoid special ed kids. So they changed they got the state legislature to change the funding formula, and now they have 5 levels of funding for special ed, depending on the severity of the disability, And they've created a citywide insurance pool. So if you have somebody who's really expensive, you dip into the insurance to pay for it. And now the charters embrace special ed kids and are creating programs for them. I could go on. They've dealt with discipline policy. They've dealt with a series of system-wide issues. And my argument is we don't want a free market in education. The only free markets in this country are black markets. Every other market is regulated by government. There are rules, and when you violate the rules, you're supposed to be caught and punished. Well, education is no different. There will be bad actors, and we need to have somebody steering and regulating. And that's what they do in New Orleans, in D.C., in Denver. And it's weak here in North Carolina.
Well, most of the laws initially in 1996, those regulations were part of the charter school law that was passed in 96 with bipartisan support in the state of North Carolina. It required that your state, school, charter school, look something like the school district demographically. I'm not clear on whether or not. I don't think transportation was a requirement.
No, I don't think it was.
It was not a requirement at the beginning. But certainly the demographics were there, and there was a cap of 100. That has slowly been stripped away, particularly in recent years, by this legislature. And so now you have a case where we just reported yesterday one operator who's a major political conservative political donor who receives money from the Koch Foundation, lives in Oregon, runs 13 schools in the state of North Carolina. Where's the accountability there? So that's what you're saying.
The accountability is to the State Board of Education.
Right.
The question is, are they doing their job? And frankly, they are not closing enough failing schools fast enough.
What about, let's go to the District of Columbia. Was that in any way, because that's another system that you profiled. Was that in any way different?
Very different.
Tell us how that.
Yeah, all of these cities have come at it differently. In 1996, Congress passed a charter law for the District of Columbia and created the Public Charter School Board. And it's appointed by the mayor. It began authorizing charters, and gradually a charter sector grew up. It has astonishing variety of school models. There are Montessori schools. There are dual language immersion schools. There are STEM schools, science, technology, engineering, and math. There are schools that have very, very high academic standards. There are schools that use project-based learning. There are what are called expeditionary learning schools where the kids do a lot of field trips and learn things out in the community. I could go on and on.
Yeah.
And they are now educating almost half the kids in D.C. And what happened in response is what usually happens. The district, as it lost children, got some urgency. And the mayor, in fact, finally, after three tries, a mayor convinced the city council to do away with the elected school board for the district, give him control. He appointed a chancellor named Michelle Rhee, who many people remember was famous on the cover of Time magazine. She went in and she just turned the apple cart upside down. She fired a lot of people. She created, she got raised teacher salaries dramatically and did a lot of important things. My hat is off to her and her successor, Kaya Henderson, and now Antoine Wilson as chancellor. But the interesting thing is both sectors have improved rapidly. So on the national test, the NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, D.C. is improving faster than any state, and D.C. public schools, the district, is improving faster than 20 other districts, big city districts that take the NAEP. But if you look at poor kids, low-income kids, and African-American kids, the charters vastly outperform them. The district hasn't figured out, you know, it's good at educating middle-class kids. It's got a standardized curriculum that's high quality. But what happens when the kids are 3 or 4 years behind grade level? Your curriculum's no use at all. You've got to handcraft the school for those kids, and the charters have the flexibility to do it.
And are they required in D.C. to provide transportation and lunch?
Certainly lunch for anyone, any student who qualifies. And,
yeah,
in fact, if 40% qualify in a school, everybody gets it.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation is more complicated. They don't provide it, neither the district. Well, what the district does is it pays for public transportation, free public transportation, mm-hmm, to the kids. Now, most of the district schools, half the parents choose and half the parents go to a neighborhood school. The charters are all schools of choice, and they handle transportation differently. Some provide it, some don't.
Is that a requirement? A state like North Carolina, again, the headline in today's News and Observer, why North Carolina charter schools are richer and whiter. And even one of the greatest, the main proponent here in the state of North Carolina, Daryl Ellison, who is a pro-charter, has a pro-charter organization, says this state has to provide transportation. If you don't provide the buses, you will have unequal education.
Absolutely. There are a series of things you have to do. Transportation, enrollment system that doesn't favor certain kinds of parents. And frankly, I believe we should all do what Denver is doing with many schools, which is saying, look, we want integrated schools by income and race. Now, the Supreme Court won't let us do it by race anymore, but they will let us do it by income. So there are about 30 schools in Denver, half charters, half district schools, where they say we're going to have at least 40% or at least 50% kids who qualify for subsidized meals. So low income kids from low income families. And once those seats are filled, then we fill the rest of them, you know, with the rest of the kids. But that way we get integrated schools. I think, you know, I believe that in a multicultural, multiracial democracy like ours, people from different walks of life and with different skin color need to rub elbows. We need to get to know each other. We need to develop tolerance. Otherwise, things really don't work too well.
They had that system in Raleigh, one of the best, and had one of the best outcomes in the country. And then they elected a new school board and they got rid of it.
Is that right?
Not right, but they did it. So let's talk more about what can be done now, because again, it seems that that God dwells in the details here. That how you craft the charter school mandate determines the outcome and whether or not it's going to be good for all or just some or good at all. Right?
Yeah. My argument would be that the chartering as a model, a way to run a system of schools, has proven that it's far more effective. I mean, the national data is overwhelming. Because the old system is over a century old, and the world has changed. So we're evolving this new approach. But with anything new, you know, there's a lot you need to figure out along the way, and you can do it well, you can do it poorly. I just came from Detroit last week, which is a mess. They have the majority of their kids in charters, but because they have a very poor charter law and 14 authorizers in the city of Detroit, many of whom don't do their jobs well, the system's a mess. So, you know, and in North Carolina, the system is not perfect by any means. So how you structure it is very important. And I think we need to understand that if you want to really steer the system, doing it at the local level is going to work better. Something like D.C., where you've got a public charter school board for the city, or Denver, where the elected school board authorizes lots of charters. Yeah. That gives you the control so that you can make sure you have a transportation and an enrollment system and deal with special ed and deal with discipline policies and so on.
And it seems to me, and I don't have much time left, but the idea, in the places where it's worked, it does seem that both local control was important, so not at the state level, but right there at the local level, and treating the whole thing as a system, even though there are independent units that can go their separate ways, but we see you as an ecosystem,
exactly.
Not as independent actors.
It's a system that is a network of independent operators operating by a set of rules rather than one unified organization with thousands of employees. And one reason that's important is that if you're an elected school board member or a superintendent and you have thousands of employees, you can't afford to get them too angry. You can't change things too fast because you'll get a backlash and you'll lose your job. That's one reason school districts change so slowly. But if you've got a network of independent operators, and let's say you close one of them and replace it with another, you'll get a protest from one building, but not from the whole system. So politically, you're no longer captive.
David Osborne, the author of Reinventing America's Schools, Creating a 21st Century Education System. He's going to be speaking tonight, 7:30, at North Carolina State University's James B. Hunt Library Auditorium. That conversation is hosted by Education NC. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about a new novel that reimagines the miracle of Hickory. Stay with us on The State of Things.